BJ, if you're ready to jump back in now, we'll let you give us the walleye stocking and valuations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the Commission, Secretary Roebling. I'm going to share a screen. Chris, is it possible to add me as a host?
Yep. Okay, should be good.
All right. Hopefully you all can see the presentation. So this was a large analysis that was conducted by myself and my supervisor, Dave Lucchese, down in the southeast part of the state, in cooperation with Brian Blackwell from the northeast, and Dr. Jeff Wesner out of the University of South Dakota. And it's something that we're continuing to work on, and we're hoping to eventually publish this into a peer-reviewed journal. But it's looking at 20 years worth of our walleye stocking data. Basically, we're trying to identify any factors that impacted the success of walleye recruitment in our systems in eastern South Dakota lakes. First, I'd like to acknowledge a bunch of people, all the staff in the southeast and the northeast, who for 20 years have been collecting all the data that we compiled, along with the Blue Dog State Fish Hatchery staff, who were responsible for raising these fish that we ended up putting into our waters. And also Nikolai O'Hara, he helped us greatly with pulling all this data from our database, which is not an easy task, and we ended up sending him several requests. Plus, we had lots of interns, seasonals, volunteers who joined us on lake surveys throughout these years, who were also very important to getting the data collected. And then finally, we have all of this occurred, both the initial sampling and the current analysis, using sport fish restoration dollars, which fund a lot of this work that we do with our walleye population. So before we actually talk about the main part of the research, I just want to point out that we do a lot with walleye research in South Dakota because they are so important. There are several recent projects that have been completed looking at walleye population and or stocking effects in our waters. For instance, the folks at Blue Dog State Fish Hatchery have been working on improving pond production. They've actually doubled their fingerling walleye output by fertilizing their ponds. Once those fish then get stocked into the lake, we've done several evaluations of those fish. There was a work done by biologists up in the Northeast, Todd Kaufman, who he looked at age zero electrofishing catch rates and compared that to age two gillnet catch rates, trying to see if fall age zero electrofishing is a good indicator of whether or not a population is going to appear 2 years later. Kind of found variable results, but they did find some meaningful utility of that age zero fall electrofishing as a good indicator of whether or not you're going to have a year class produced. And then recently there was a study on Lower Lake Oahe where walleye fingerlings were stocked in 2017 through 2019. And the biologists out there, Mark Finsel and Cameron Goebel in particular, pulled some otoliths from those fish, aging structures, bones, and they sent them off to a lab to have them processed and identified which fish came from stocked year classes and which were naturally reproduced fish. And they found that anywhere from 23 to 51% of the fish in Lower Lake Oahe were stocked, and that those fish were a similar size to the natural fish, and that the abundance of age zero stocked fish was fairly similar to up in the upper reaches of Lake Oahe. So finding that there's meaningful contribution of stocked fish to Lower Lake Oahe where recruitment was limited. And there's ongoing research. So this spring, we started experimenting with a growth hormone called Corulon. And the goal of this was to take females who still were carrying their eggs but weren't quite ready to spawn, and which we call green females, and try and induce spawning with them. The hope was that we would shorten the spawning window and then make the meaningful contribution of eggs come quicker, which would hopefully improve hatch rates Early results though that showed that it wasn't as effective as we were hoping in terms of getting those green females to ripen up as compared to just what was happening naturally in our nets. So there's continuing evaluation going on at Blue Dog with that. And then out in Cleghorn Springs State Fish Hatchery, they're working on some walleye rearing with recirculating aquaculture systems, which is kind of the future of production. And it's something that our state is diving into and starting to take a look at. And we'll talk a little bit more about at the end here. But the ultimate goal for all these research projects is basically to understand how to create high walleye year class strength in South Dakota waters. And basically another way to say that is we want to create high quality walleye fisheries that allow anglers to get out there, catch and harvest walleyes. And that's the ultimate goal for all the research. Today, the objectives that for the current research study that I'm going to talk about is that we're utilizing a 20 years worth of data and just basically taking our existing sampling and stocking databases and assessing walleye recruitment to our waters from historic data. And then we used environmental factors, either weather conditions or even just conditions within the lakes themselves to determine what was really impacting recruitment of fish to our fish population. And then ultimately we hoped we could develop a predictive model to inform our stocking decision. So have a model that could tell us based on the conditions of the fish that were stocked and or the conditions at the time they were stocked, whether or not it was going to be a successful stocking and what that would mean 2 years later for the fish population. Just a teaser, we weren't able to do that last one, and you'll see why here as we jump into results in a little bit. So the first thing I need to talk about is just what we were using as our index for considering something recruited. So using the word recruitment here, we evaluated everything with age to walleye gill net catch. So in every lake that we sample each year, we set several gill nets. That can range from anywhere from 3 to 20 gill nets in a lake. So within a given water body in a year, we were looking at the average walleye catch rate for age two only fish. So if a fish was stocked in 2020, in 2022, we would catch that fish as an age two walleye in our gill net survey. And then we can evaluate the impact of that stocking or whether or not, or in non-stocked years too, the impacts of natural recruitment to our system. And so everything you're going to see from here on out is age two oriented. And so the variables that we were looking at in these models that we were developing, trying to predict success of walleye stockings, first started with our stocking information. We wanted to look at the size of the fish that were stocked, whether or not they were fry, which down in the bottom right picture, those are fish that are just recently hatched from their eggs. We have small fingerlings, that picture in the upper right in the hand of the biologist who was stocking those fish. Then we also have large fingerling fish, which you can see down in that lower left picture in the bucket. So varying sizes that we stock throughout the course of the year. We stock at varying densities as well. And there was a research project back in about 2013 that kind of evaluated this a little bit more thoroughly, but I'm just going to rehash a little bit of that results. Stocking date. Does that make an impact? If we stock too early, is it going to be too cold? If we stock too late, is it too warm? Things like that. We also evaluated characteristics of the water body. So we have natural lakes in eastern South Dakota, but we also have impoundments, small reservoirs. We wanted to see if it makes a difference where we're stocking those fish. We also classified fish kind of based on perceived trends that we've seen in those waters, whether they're consistent waters. So those consistent waters have consistent walleye populations that they're fairly persistent in the system. They last for a long time. Marginal waters are the waters where if we weren't stocking them, we probably wouldn't have a really good walleye population. And then we also looked at a couple of environmental variables. The first one is growing degree days. It's basically just adding up the daily temperature during the warm period of the year. So you get a big number at the end of the year that corresponds to how warm it was throughout the course of the year. And typically you tend to see kind of an increase in especially at the early ages of walleye, increase in walleye growth and production as you increase temperatures. We also looked at winter severity index, which is kind of the opposite. Larger numbers of winter severity index means that it was a more severe winter, and more severe winters likely mean a higher mortality, particularly at those early ages for juvenile walleye. And then finally, we looked at spring precipitation, seeing if changes in precipitation influence walleye production. So we did a lot of digging with our data. There were a couple of issues we had to deal with. We switched gear in the middle of this study. So in 2016 and 17, we switched from what were like an old style of standardized gill nets that South Dakota had been using for years to a new gear called the American Fisheries Society Standard Gill Net. So we had to do some manipulation of the data there to make sure those numbers matched accordingly. We had to exclude some information where there were either missing or we were unsure of certain characteristics. For instance, you know, something that was called an adult or a juvenile, we didn't know exactly what size those were when they were stocked. If there were multiple stockings in a year, we had to exclude some of that. So we cleaned up our data, and then this is kind of the final result. So this is just a frequency graph of all of the average gill net catches across 776 lake and year combinations. So over the course of 20 years, we had 776 data points to work with of average age two gill net catch. And as you can see by looking at the graph on that left-hand side, most of the time we had gill net catches that ranged from 0 to 1 fish per gill net on average, and then a lot of 1 to 5 as well. And in 132 instances, we had no walleye collected in a survey where we were probably expecting to collect walleye. So we use a statistical approach. I'm not really going to go into any of the specifics on this just because it's fairly complex, but we used what's called a generalized linear model or generalized linear mixed effect model. And basically what you need to know is that it allowed us to account for the variation among the lakes that we were sampling. So for instance, on the left is Lake Thompson. That's one of our lakes in the Southeast that we sample on an annual basis. So we had 19 years worth of sampling data and an average walleye catch at age two of about 9.5 fish. Now we compare that to East Oakwood Lake. We only sampled that 3 times during that 20-year period where we had age two data available, and the average catch was 2.8. So we have different sample sizes, we have different averages for a large number of waters across the state. So this allowed us to, this modeling approach allowed us to account for that variability among the lakes that were sampled, the number of times we sampled them, and the catch rates differing among lakes. So we developed kind of a list of questions that we wanted to model. And the first one was the lake stocked? So that's the most simple model. Then we looked at the size of the fish stocked and whether or not it was a consistent or a marginal water body that they got stocked into. We then looked at density and stocking date. So those were our stocking variables. We looked at the conditions of the lakes they were going into, the lake area, is it natural or an impoundment, and then the consistency again. We looked at those 3 environmental conditions, growing degree day, winter severity index, and spring precipitation. And then we also looked at the influence of fish populations that were already existing in those lakes. And I'm going to talk about 2 centrarchids, which were the bluegill and crappie populations, and then the adult walleye population. So wondering if centrarchids have an impact. Usually it's negative on walleye populations. And then adult walleye, seeing if there was any kind of relationship between more adult walleye representing or relating to more juvenile walleye in the system. So here's our results, starting with the first most simple model. You can basically ignore all of these R squared values up in the top. Higher values of those just mean the model fits better. We don't have great model fit on any of our models. And that's something I'll touch on at the end. So this was probably one of our simplest models to understand in that if we stocked a lake we were much more likely to see higher H2 walleye catch rates than if we did not stock that lake. And with our modeling approach, we were able to come up with some probability statements. And so in this case, there was a 94% probability that catch rate would be twice as high in stocked years compared to non-stocked years. So we know that stocking is effective. We know that stocking results in higher year classes. We also know that stocking prevents us from having a missing year class. In our stocked years, about 8% of the time, we would have a zero catch or a missing year class. In those non-stocked years, it was about 22% of the time. So it was nearly three times higher chance of having a zero if we did not stock that lake. Looking at the stocking size and consistency, we're going to start here by talking about size. We see this slightly higher average catch rate with walleye fry. There's a fair amount of overlap in our confidence intervals or our credible intervals here, which means there's a good amount of potential for these things to be very similar. But just looking at small fingerling and fry, those are the two that we stock most commonly. It was something like an 86% probability that fry would result in more fish on average at age two than if we stocked small fingerlings. And then if you look at the difference here between the black and the gray bars, you see our consistent waters tended to have much higher results than our marginal waters, which is what we would expect. And it was about an 88% probability that our fry would be higher in a consistent water and about 93% probability that our fry stock or our small fingerling stockings would result in a higher catch rate in a consistent water compared to a marginal water. So it seems like fry are one of the things that we might be targeting in the future. And again, that'll be something that we discuss here at the end. But moving beyond those simple comparisons, the rest of these, what you're going to see is there's not a lot of trends that really show up in our models. So here is the number of small fingerling stocked. So the density, number stocked per acre. And then the resultant catch 2 years later is age two fish. And you can see there's kind of a peak right in the middle of the stocking density. And this is something that we've seen or that was observed in the study back in 2013 that we've kind of implemented. We no longer stock high densities of fish because we don't really see the return or the you know, more stocking, larger numbers of fish going into a water body does not result in higher catch rates of walleye. So we have to kind of find the right balance when we stock those fish. Looking at the stocking dates, so I have the Julian date, but just for simplicity's sake, you know, these are rough approximations of the dates. On the left is fry, on the right is small fingerlings. You can see there's not much of a relationship. You might have a little bit greater chance of having high H2 catch rates kind of in the middle of our stocking windows for both fry and fingerlings, but it's not that strong of a relationship. Moving on to lake area type and consistency, there's a lot of overlap in what we see with water body type and even water body consistency. Natural basins tend to have slightly higher catch, but it's not overly meaningful compared to impoundments. Consistent waters do have higher catch than marginal, but again, it's not overly consistent among years. And then when we look at the surface acres of the lake, larger lakes don't necessarily produce more walleye than smaller lakes. In fact, you can see some of our highest walleye catches occurred on some of our smallest waters, actually. So whether that's a function of our sampling events or whether that's a function of those smaller lakes being really highly productive when those fish were being stocked, maybe those lakes were winter kill lakes and we restocked fish after a winter kill and they had prime conditions. There's a lot of factors that could go into that, but we don't really see a difference in the size of the water body in terms of follow-up with age two walleye catch rates. And then again, environmental variables, you can see on all three of these graphs, the growing degree days, the winter severity, and the spring precipitation. It just looks like somebody took a shotgun to the graphs on each of these. There's really no relationships here. We're not seeing anything that's a strong, meaningful, positive or negative relationship between growing degree day, winter severity index, or precipitation. One interesting relationship that we did find, though, was with centrarchid abundance. So as, again, with our centrarchids, we're talking about bluegill and black crappie. As you get higher catch rates of bluegill and black crappie, you tend to have lower catches of H2 walleyes. Bluegills and black crappies can predate on juvenile fry and fingerling walleyes. And so there's likely some kind of predatory effect that goes on when you have really high densities of centrarchids in a system. And then with adult walleye abundance, there was really no relationship. You can see from the gray shaded area there, it kind of blows up on the right hand side of the graph. Really having a higher catch of walleye in our gill nets does not result in having more juvenile walleye down the road. So we don't have any kind of really strong effect of a standing adult walleye biomass resulting in lots of natural recruitment of fish into a system. So what we can glean from that is adult walleye abundance is not going to tell us much about what's coming down the road. So the conclusions of all of that was basically that there were few factors that were really good predictors. We know that stocking is effective and it's likely going to produce catch rates that are about twice as high as if we didn't stock. And we did see some positive or some kind of relationship with centrarchids, but those were about the only two things that we saw that had really meaningful relationships. There was a lot of variability in catch from year to year, but that's very similar to what's been produced in a lot of other walleye stocking research. So this isn't, these results aren't very different from what states like Minnesota and Wisconsin have seen. Really, it's really challenging to predict and understand walleye recruitment. And as I mentioned early on, we were unable to develop that high quality predictive model. So we were able to tease out a couple of things, particularly with our stocking, but what it allowed us to do is it allowed us to develop further avenues for study. And in particular, one of those is that comparison of fry and fingerling stockings. Fry are much less expensive to produce than small fingerlings. So if we were seeing that there was a greater probability of success with fry stockings compared to fingerling stockings, it seems like that might be an opportunity for the department to potentially save some money and reduce the number of small fingerling stockings that we do. We're also going to look into the production techniques for large fingerlings. That's actually going to be ongoing this year, doing some rearing of large fingerlings at Blue Dog's fish hatchery this year, instead of stocking the fish out and then collecting them in natural rearing ponds, you know, small ponds out throughout the countryside, like we have done in the past. These fish tend to go into those centrarchid dominated lakes to try and get past that early predation effect. So that's going to continue. And then finally, we're going to have a fairly substantial look at recirculating aquaculture systems as we go forward. RAS systems are being implemented in a lot of our neighboring states. Wyoming has them, Iowa has them, Nebraska and Kansas are working with them. And we're starting to develop some systems out in the western part of the state. And we'll continue to expand that into the eastern side here in the future. Recirculating aquaculture is really great because it allows you to control the conditions, the water temperatures, the chemical inputs. It also allows you to be more secure from an invasive species standpoint, because all of this, the water is contained within that system and it's recirculating. You don't have the inputs like a flow through system where you pull lake water into your hatchery. So there are a lot of benefits to recirculating aquaculture. There are still a lot of questions about how those fish respond once they are stocked into a lake. And those questions are being studied by other states right now. And at the point when we get to stocking our fish out, into our waters, that will be an evaluation that we start, you know, maybe in 2023 or 2024. So that's all I have for you. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to take them.
Thanks, BJ. Anybody have any questions for BJ? Commissioner Whitmer?
Yeah, Commissioner Whitmer. Yeah, interesting. Thank you, BJ. It's a great report on, it looked to me like on the fingerling stockings, around 90 fingerlings, if I read the data correctly, per acre was kind of a sweet spot for success. When you look at comparing the fry per acre, I mean, obviously fry, your survivability to get to be fingerlings, you're going to have to allow extra fry for that. But do you have an idea when you put in fry versus the 90 fingerlings per acre, how many? And then, of course, coming back to cost on a per acre basis, how much less expensive is it to put in, say, 500 fry per acre versus 90 fingerlings per acre? Do you have an idea? Just, I mean, I don't need exact numbers, but if it's double or triple or anything.
Yeah, I won't be able to give you exact numbers on the cost. I know I've heard those from the folks up at the Budog Hatchery, and unfortunately, I don't know those numbers off the top of my head. What it costs to produce corresponding numbers of fry versus small fingerlings. I do know that when we stock our fry, we try to target densities. I believe the number is around 700 per acre. Between 700 and 1,000 per acre. So it's a lot more, but the investment is a lot lower because those fry come out of the facility through the tubes and go right into a holding tank where they can get scooped out and delivered right to the lake, versus having to store them in ponds where the ponds get fertilized. The staff are you know, watching over the ponds. So the cost per stocking a lake of fry versus fingerlings, I guess I can't tell you those numbers off the top of my head.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you. It was interesting data, and I was just kind of looking at that. And two, on the RAS systems, we were able to get a great tour out west, and I think it was at Cleghorn where they were mentioning kind of a connection with SDSU. Are there any thoughts of testing those out at the Blue Dog Fish Hatchery, you know, kind of right where those eggs are harvested and where we have a lot of staff already? It just seemed to be like an opportunity to kind of keep things all consolidated and maybe more economically feasible to have that up there. Is that a consideration? Do you know?
Yeah, so, you know, the current system that's set up at Cleghorn, the reason why they were able to set that one up is because they had an old visitor system that they was kind of just a storage closet where they were actually storing some of the equipment that it was needed for the RAS system to begin with. So they kind of set that system up at a low cost. In order to set something up at Blue Dog, I think would be much more expensive, given that they don't have the space and the infrastructure for that at the moment. I think the one of the conversations from what I, you know, what I've gleaned in these discussions is that there are plans to have a system set up in and around Pier potentially in the future as well. So looking at Pier, Blue Dog and South Dakota State, you know, all having, you know, potential for RAS systems to be developed. I think what our department's goal and you know, these are all conversations that are probably better answered by John Lott or Mike Barnes, the folks who are the administrators. But I believe we're working towards understanding how these RAS systems are going to work within our state at an early stage, which is why Cleghorn was a great starting point, because the facilities were fairly low cost to put together. And then as we get closer to development, we'll figure out how to build larger systems from there for future evaluations and actual production level walleye growth.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments for BJ? I'd just say hats off to you and the other three contributing research partners that you had on this. It gives a higher level of credibility that you had the University of South Dakota work with you too. So thanks for including them in that.
Thank you.
All right.